Well, good morning. This is Per Fogren, KBOO News and Public Affairs. A little bit of Thelonious Monk there, who got a Pulitzer Prize for a lifetime achievement recently. Too bad he didn't get it 20 years ago and he was still alive. But anyway, our guest is Anne Hunt Work, who is a longtime Portland peace activist, a member of the School of the Americas Watch. And welcome to KBOO, Anne.
Thank you very much.
Well, I guess we start out by telling people that Father Roy Bourgeois, who is sort of the instigator of this group, is going to be here in Portland Saturday, May 6th. So that is actually 1 week from tomorrow. And he will be at the St. Francis Church, which is at 12th and Pine, right up the street from KBOO, at 7 p.m. So he will be talking about this struggle to shut down the school. They haven't shut it down. They got it to change its name a few times, I think. But anyway, it seems to me more and more people show up for these demonstrations down at Fort Benning. So, Anne, fill us in, what's going on now?
Well, actually, quite a bit has been going on. Some people may already know that after the change in regime, so to speak, in Venezuela, that Venezuela now no longer sends any students to the School of the Americas. And Father Roy just recently came back from a trip to Latin America, and we now have Uruguay and Argentina, as well as Venezuela. And I just talked to the office this morning, and they're saying that Bolivia is very close to making that decision also. So we're very happy. If you dry up the source, so to speak, it will make a big impact on the School of the Americas watch.
That is interesting, yeah, because Uruguay, I was thinking of Ecuador. Uruguay is dropped out, and Argentina, and does Brazil still send troops there?
They do, but they're also under observation and effort by some of the folks from the School of the Americas Watch.
And, of course, Mexico does send troops,
right,
too.
Right, yes. And in fact, one of the reasons that people wonder how we know about what the graduates do right after the Chiapas stuff started getting hot, the enrollment from Mexico suddenly shot way high, much more than they had previously done, in order to squelch activities like that in their country.
Well, I've been reading quite a few reports that, you know, the Mexican army is really harassing the Zapatistas. You know, of course, this has been happening ever since their rebellion, which was, my gosh, it was about, 11 years ago,
I think. It's been a while, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, they've been sort of surrounded, you know, in their communities in the Chiapas. They've been surrounded by the army and everything. And, of course, right now, this big, huge uproar over immigration from Mexico. Well, one of the reasons for that immigration is that the what I call the empire, which includes the corporations and the armies and everything else, have made life unbearable for many people in Mexico. So where are they going to go?
That's right. I remember a few years ago, some people were being interviewed in Georgia, and one guy said, you know, if I did in Latin America what I do in this country, I would be dead. And he was a labor organizer. And if he had been doing that in Mexico or Colombia or some of the other places, he would have been killed.
Oh, I think in Colombia, I guess they have the worst record for union people getting killed. I mean, it gets up
very
into
bad.
The hundreds,
yes.
Or something, you know. And this is our sort of main ally in South America, you know.
Right.
Practically a one remaining ally. And, you know, if that kind of stuff was going on, say, in Cuba, we would never hear the end of it.
That's right.
But since it happens in an ally, we don't hear about it at all. You know, it's just what is the next demonstration going to be at Benning? Are these ongoing, or are they just mainly once? They're ongoing then all year round.
Yeah. Well, there are people who come at different parts of the year. The big big gathering, of course, is the one in November, and that one is usually the weekend before Thanksgiving. And it commemorates the murder of six Jesuit priests and one of their female colleagues and her daughter back in 1979.
Now, that was in El Salvador, was
right.
it?
Yeah. Actually, it was 89, sorry.
And then there were the nuns who were killed in El Salvador also.
Right, yeah.
Plus Bishop Oscar Romero.
Right.
And, of course, El Salvador still sends troops to...
That's
trained.
Right. One interesting thing that happened was that the major archbishop who was responsible for the report on Guatemala, the day after the report was issued, he was gunned down also.
That's right, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
So lots is going on down there still.
Yeah. What is the training like at the School of Americas? What do they teach? Do we have any reports of what their classes
are
like?
Well, yeah, and we've looked at their class calendars and catalogs, and they give lip service to human rights. It's a very short course, which talks mm-hmm. about giving your name and number and that kind of stuff mm-hmm. if you're taken as a prisoner of war. But basically, the training hasn't changed over the years. I mean, they aren't as overt now about giving you actual courses on torture, but the manuals that were released a few years ago are still floating around down in Central America and Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So they're still available to people.
Well, I think what they do with the torture classes is they make it seem we are teaching you how to resist torture techniques in case you're ever captured. And so you got to know what the techniques are. And, of course, you know, use it as you will, I suppose.
It's very, very sad because I think a lot of people who are there in the Army, a lot of them don't even know what's going on the base.
Mm-hmm.
We had the first year I was there, I was sitting waiting to be booked, and next to me was a young man who said, you know, I was here a few years ago, and I used to drive those guys from the School of the Americas around to the bank and into town mm-hmm. and stuff like mm-hmm. that. I had no idea that this is what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
year he was on the other side and being arrested for visiting the base in a
really?
Different capacity. Yeah.
Well, actually, I myself was at Fort Benning, but this is long before the school moved from Panama,
uh-huh.
you know, and I was in an outlying area, not pretty far from the main base anyway, but there's just sort of normal military activities going on there and stuff.
And a lot of, mm-hmm. there's a lot more dissent now among recruits. There have been increased numbers of suicides on the base,
mm-hmm.
Increased numbers of people going AWOL or calling for conscientious objector status. In fact, last November when we were down there, a woman took a stand and gave a press conference at the gate with Father Roy that she was not going to go into weapons training. She had learned too much about what went on to, just as an Army person, just in the regular Army part, that's not even including the School of the Americas.
Mm.
So generally speaking, our military, and one would hope that would rub off on some of the Latin America military, are getting more and more aware of what they're being called on to do.
Mm-hmm. So what was going to happen to this woman?
I haven't heard lately. She was to be court-martialed, I think. We did have another resistor who went AWOL, and they have this system of if you report back in within a certain number of days, I think it's 45, you won't be court-martialed. And so he took the time right up until that, and then he went back in, and he got a less than honorable discharge. But he's in Corvallis right now as a student, a very
mm-hmm.
articulate young man.
Mm-hmm. I see. Do you get any, you hear from people who actually went through that training who talk about it, or do they?
We haven't actually heard of anything like that. We have heard, of course, from people who have participated in doing the training.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a video about a major who was a trainer for a long time and who began to see that what the school graduates were doing was untenable, and he just quit and is now publicizing against the school.
Oh, really? What has he said about it?
He said that at some point, maybe when we were talking about communism, people bought into the idea, you know, that the communism was spreading in Latin America, and this was our way of holding out against it. And he's seeing that it's extended way past that now, and it's really dealing with any democratic activities in any countries are being squelched by these folks who are graduates.
Well, I think that was always a case. And now instead of communism, it's terrorism.
Oh, right.
Or it's
whatever.
Bolivarian Chavista revolution. You know, there's all kinds of little boogeymen that they come
That's
up
right.
with.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that there are quite a number of, some pretty well-known military people who sort of had the... you know, they actually saw what they were doing. The most famous would be General Smedley Butler.
Oh, yes.
He was this Marine Corps hero. He was, I think he got two Congressional Medals of Honor, which is very rare. And then he was in for about 30 years. He retired around 1930, so he basically served the first third of the last century. And he was in Haiti and Nicaragua and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the way, he realized that, well, he gave a speech that grew into a book called War is a Racket.
Mm-hmm.
And he just talked of himself as being a kind of a gun enforcer for the corporations.
Yeah, and I think a lot of U.S. Americans don't realize how much military activity has gone on in the Southern Hemisphere over the years. We think of the two world wars and the Korean War and the Vietnam War, but there's been a whole lot of other military activity that's gone on that is kind of behind the scenes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had troops and we had the Marines in Haiti, I think, with 1915, and they didn't leave until 1934.
Right.
And then when they did leave, they left behind some dictator or something, and then the Duvaliers, Papa Doc and Baby Doc, grew out of that. And
right, exactly.
Yeah. So, there's another former military man I read about now. His name is Stan Goff.
I haven't heard him.
And he was actually a master sergeant in the Green Berets.
Wow.
And he taught classes at West Point. And somewhere along the way, he saw the reality, and he is now, he's retired, and he lives in North Carolina, and he writes for Mike Rupert's newsletter, the From the Wilderness, but he's become really anti-empire and anti-racist, and he's a pretty hard-hitting guy.
That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people like that really have a lot of credibility, or they should have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of us who haven't ever been involved in that kind of thing, they say, well, you're naive, you don't know what it's all about, and all that kind of stuff. But these generals that are coming out and others that are that have been through it, McCain, for example, they really know what war is like, and they know what people have to do in wartime, and they're the ones now that are standing up against our imperial activities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, when you talk to military people, do they ever think about the fact that so many of these, I call them the Washington warlords, never served in the military themselves? And of course, Cheney's a horrible example.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean,
he
had five chances, you know, to serve in Vietnam, but he didn't. You know, it'd be one thing if he was against the war, but he liked the war. He just and here he is, you know, sending. Do they talk about that much, or does that get through to them?
I don't know too much about that. One of the things that's really scary to me is how quickly, excuse me, how quickly people buy into the idea that you have to do what you're told.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, when we were there, one of our folks was walking along, and there were a couple of soldiers, young soldiers, with him, and he was saying, you know, what do you have to do everything they tell you, and what if they tell you to do something against your conscience, and they say, well, you just don't have a conscience. And so mm-hmm. Jim said to this very personable young man, well, suppose I go on the base and your officer says this man is a threat, shoot him. He said, what would you do? He said, I'd shoot you. I'd shoot you, sir, he said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was perfectly straightforward. I mean, there was no question about it in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And how quickly that soaks in to people, that kind of sense of I have to obey no matter what.
Well, it's kind of catch-22 thing because, you know, the Nuremberg trial of the Nazi war criminals, was the principle was that saying I was following orders is no excuse. In other words, even, you know, if you're in the military, you are obligated to refuse to follow criminal laws. You know, of course, it's up to the person to decide what that is. But then on the other hand, I mean, you know, there are a lot of retired generals now who are saying Rumsfeld should quit or be fired.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the arguments that is being used against them is that these are military people and they shouldn't be kind of messing around with, with their civilian superiors. So, I don't know. Where do you, it's kind of hard to navigate your way through this, these legalities.
Yeah. Well, certainly those people who stood against the My Lai situation years ago, they had a lot of trouble over the years before things got straightened out for them because they were going against orders also.
That's true. Well, it's interesting. Speaking of My Lai, you know, the Lieutenant William Calley wound up living in Columbus, Georgia.
That's right, and he used to play golf with the guy who was our judge in the early days.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I think he owns a grocery, jewelry store there.
That's right. That's he's the owner. Okay. And mm-hmm. he's still there?
I haven't heard in the last few years, but there wasn't any reason for him to leave. Nobody seemed to feel unpleasant. Not liking to have him there. He seemed to be doing business.
Uh-huh. Did he seem happy with himself, or did he...
I don't know. I've often been tempted to see if I could find the place and go in and just see.
Yeah.
I haven't done
that.
It's always too busy down there. The schedule, the November schedule is very, very busy.
Well, he seemed like he got off pretty easy from the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, he was, you know, I mean, they should have gone... Well, they did try and go higher up in the chain of command responsible for that massacre, but I believe he was sentenced to, I don't know, a few years confinement or something like that. Not even jail, and then uh-huh. he was sort of freed after.
Right. The judge freed him,
mm-hmm.
basically.
And I think they tried to
dismissed
go after
everything.
The captain above him, but after that, it's kind of like the whole thing with the Abu Ghraib tortures, mm-hmm. you know. They got all these enlisted people, and they got, I think they finally went after some major, and then, of course, this General Karpinski, she was demoted.
Mm-hmm.
But so what is being planned for future demonstrations?
Well, there will be another one in November, and mm-hmm. the since 9/11, anyone who goes on the base will have a sentence. They will be tried and sentenced.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, they'll get probation, but generally speaking, they'll get prison time.
What kind of, how long
and
are we talking about?
It gets more stringent as the time goes along.
Mm-hmm.
Every year before, they've done what they call a pre-sentencing investigation. And that's, the parole officers in Georgia run that. And that is sent to the prison that the person will be reporting to. And basically it says that this person is eligible to be in the camp section, which is the minimum security. Well, this year, they did do pre-sentencing investigations, and the last time I heard, which was last week, those 29 people were all in what they call a SHU, Special Housing Unit, which is a segregation
mm-hmm.
unit,
mm-hmm.
the whole, basically, until it could be cleared as to what level of security they needed.
And so what are the sentence, like a year, 2 years?
No. 6 months is the maximum.
6 months,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and some people have done several, 2 or 3 6-month terms.
Right.
Yeah,
and this is in the Georgia state prison system. That
well, no, they assign you to whatever federal prison.
Oh, federal
is
prison.
Fairly
okay.
near. Oh, yeah, you go to a federal prison.
I see.
Because
okay.
it's federal
That's
land
right.
that you
yeah.
are on.
Yeah. Uh huh.
And so there are prisons all over the country that have had our prisoners, and we're well over 100 years in time served now by the numbers of people that we've had.
Now you served some time yourself.
I
didn't
did.
You?
Where six
you,
months?
You were in. It was in California.
Yes.
Is that where you were?
Uh-huh, in Dublin.
Okay. What kind of a place was that anyway?
It was an old army barracks place.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually on a base,
mm-hmm.
and we laughed a little bit about that because we got busted for going on a base, and then we were jailed on the base.
confined
yes.
to the barracks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Very old. Buildings.
Oh, those old wooden barracks
yeah,
and stuff?
Yeah,
gee whiz, uh-huh.
Dormitory style.
Right, yeah, uh-huh.
And as far as I know, the three or four that are going to be in there this time are still in the segregated area until they get their investigations done.
And then they might get moved someplace else.
They should be moved into the camp, yeah.
And the camp is like what? That's
The camp is, it's like I described, it's more like a dormitory kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no fences, but if you cross a certain line, you get 5 years without any questions asked. So people
really?
Generally don't go across that.
Wow, 5 years.
Since most of the mm-hmm. people in there are short-term, you know.
Sure, uh-huh.
Many of them have only 5 years. Although I had one friend there who has got an 11-year term, and she was serving it in the camp.
For crossing the line?
No.
No, wait,
no,
for,
no.
For...
That was for another. That was a regular prisoner, as they used to say. The regular prisoners and then the political prisoners.
Oh, explain that some more. So.
Well, it's a... Most of the people there are there for drug charges or conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
lots of conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
which means they might have taken a phone call for somebody that they didn't know that person was setting up a drug deal. But if they took
mm-hmm.
the phone call, they go. Quite a few
right.
people like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do they get many so-called terrorists or, you know, that kind of thing?
I don't think so.
Well, I guess that's just beginning to ramp up now.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah. We did have... we did have a small group of Muslims there, and mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to spend quite a bit of time with them. And the imam who came in on Friday afternoon said that they had a camp in the north of Sacramento where they had detained a number of people without charge and, you know, the usual system that we're using now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we have those, I'm sure we have those places around the country
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people just don't know about yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're kind of coming close to the end of our segment here. So once again, Father Roy Bourgeois, who was the sort of the founder, prime instigator of the School of the Americas Watch, is coming to Portland, and he will be here Saturday, May 6th at 7 p.m. That's a week from tomorrow. And it's going to be at St. Francis Church, which is up at Southeast 12th and Pine. It's a church with a nice little park there.
And he will be giving us update, I'm sure, on what's been going on his visits in Latin America,
mm-hmm.
where they managed to get so many other countries to decline to send their students, and to say something more about H.R. 1217, H.R. 1217, which you should all write to your congresspeople and tell them to take some leadership. Our entire delegation, except for Walden, is signed on as co-sponsors.
Right. What is that, Bill? What will that do?
It's called the Latin America Military Training Review Act of 2005, and it will basically suspend classes until there's a thorough review undertaken. And this is based on the Amnesty International report of a couple of years ago, and it's one of the few times that Amnesty International has ever made recommendations around a training program like that in this country.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Well, we've been talking with Ann Huntwerk, a Portland peace activist who has been in demonstrations down at Fort Benning against the, well, it's got a different name now, the mm-hmm. School of the Americas, School of the Assassins, call it what you will. And thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And once again, Father Roy Bourgeois, next Saturday, May 6th at St. Francis Church at 7 p.m. He'll be talking all about his trip to Latin America and the ongoing campaign to shut down this school. Thank you very much.
Now we're about to hear a short interview with Rodney Bender of the local nonprofit Growing Gardens. Growing Gardens is a nonprofit located in Portland, and its mission is to help community grow their own food. KBOO's Denise Kowalczyk spoke with Rodney Bender, the Gardens Program Manager, about what the organization actually provides in services and the challenges it faces.
This is our 10-year anniversary. We started in 1996. And we built, in this 10-year anniversary of ours, we built our 400th home garden this year.
That's very exciting. Congratulations. Now, most nonprofits really thrive on the help of volunteers. How many volunteers do you guys work with?
We work with hundreds of volunteers. We've had literally over 1,000 volunteers over 10 years. Over the past couple months, we've been building our home gardens for 2006, and I think we had roughly around 125 volunteers who came out on Saturdays over the past 2 months to help us.
And what kind of volunteer help do you guys usually work with? I mean, as a nonprofit, I assume there's board, there's actually program, there's mm-hmm. other things. What kind of things? If you had a wish list of five kinds of volunteer jobs that you needed to have done, what would they be?
Sure. We have many more than five. We have a little garden here at our office in Northeast in the Hollywood District that we call our backyard garden, and it's a demonstration garden of what you can grow in a small urban lot, and that is mostly run by volunteers. We definitely have some staff input in it, but we rely purely on volunteers to take care of it. Building our gardens for all of our home gardeners is a really important aspect that we would not be able to do without volunteers. We also have a youth grow program where we do after-school programs and summer camps at elementary schools in Portland, and we need volunteers for those as well. We need volunteers for office work. I mean, you name it. We can find whatever volunteer skills are, we can find something for them to do.
And as most nonprofits are struggling with, it's one of those things is funding. It sounds like you have some really great resources in your volunteer base, but I'm assuming there's some struggles, in a sense, with funding. How is your organization funded?
We have various funding sources. We do a lot of grant writing, so funding from foundations, as well as fundraisers. We do a summer dinner series. That's a lot of fun. The dinners are held in a local community member's garden, and the dinners are each dinner is cooked by a different local chef. So those are really fantastic. And then we have a lot of private donors. And right now we're actually working on the Feinstein Challenge, which is a foundation that will give a percentage of money to nonprofits that are working on anti-hunger issues. For every dollar that we raise, they will give us a percentage of money back to match that. So the Feinstein Challenge actually ends on April 30th, and we're hoping to raise around $5,500 by that point. And right now we're just a little over $4,500.
How do folks get involved in certain programs? I would assume when you have like Gardening 101, the workshop series, that's pretty straightforward on how to get involved in that. Mm-hmm. But let's say you want a garden built in your backyard. How do folks get involved in that?
If people want to enroll in the program, they can actually just call our office, 503-284-8420. And, you know, we really don't do a whole lot of advertising for the program in that way because the news of our program spreads quickly. People usually call throughout the year to say they would like to receive a garden from us. And when we ask how they heard about us, 9 times out of 10 we get an answer like, my neighbor down the street has a garden from you, or I have a friend, family member, church member. So people come to us, and we usually have a waiting list of people who want gardens.
So what would you say is the biggest challenge or even the biggest priority that Growing Gardens is facing?
I think resources, staffing, financial resources to just serve as many people as there's a need for. There's a lot of hunger and food insecurity in Portland, and there's a lot of people who would love to grow food for themselves but just don't have either the actual physical resources or the financial resources, or maybe just don't have the knowledge to do it on their own. So I think just trying to serve as many people as we possibly can.
So what do you see as what's in the future for Growing Gardens?
What's in the future? Well, we would definitely like to increase the number of gardens that we build every year. We would like to expand our Youth Grow program to provide Youth Grow services, the after-school programs and the summer camps, in more areas of Portland.
That was Rodney Bender of Growing Gardens. He spoke with KBOO's Denise Kowalczyk. For more information about the nonprofit's programs, see their website at www.growing-gardens.org.
Well, Pear Fogg back again, and our guest now is Michael Newman, who is a professor of philosophy at Trent University in Ontario, Canada, who has written recently about the what is called the Israel Lobby. Well, Michael Newman, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, there's recently, was it a month or 2 months ago, an article by Professors Mearsheimer and Walt that has it's still causing reverberations, I guess.
Well, yes, it certainly is. It's the article about, the Israel Lobby and American foreign policy.
Well, what is the Israel Lobby? Now, what does it consist of?
Well, you know, I mean, lobby's a word. You can use it strictly. You can use it not so strictly. There is certainly a lobby in the sense of a Washington organization called AIPAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, that you know, is very clearly a lobby. Everybody recognizes it as such. Walt and Mearsheimer got taken to task for using the word lobby to cover other Jewish organizations. My feeling is that rate's a big so what. I mean, what's the difference? Why does it matter?
Is AIPAC actually registered as a lobbyist? I heard that they were not, but, or maybe that's a different kind of registration.
I don't know if they're registered as a lobby, but I'll tell you one thing. If you want to find a country where they don't worry about talking not only about the Israel lobby, but about the Jewish lobby, they talk about it all the time, one place to look is Israel.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to find in the Israeli press references to both the Israel lobby and the Jewish lobby. It's mainly in the United States that people sort of go run and hide in the bushes when you use words like this. And as Ralph Nader pointed out in a very good article last year, I mean, the level of piety involved in talking about Israel in the United States is not at all mirrored in Israel itself.
Mm-hmm.
In Israel itself, you don't have to worry about what you say nearly as much as in the U.S.
Oh, I know, because I follow some of the Israeli press and some of the critics over, you know, in Israel, gee whiz, if they were, you know, they're really strident critics. I just think of, Tanya Reinhardt and Uri Avneri and the late Israel Shahak, and just go on and on and on, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's important to realize that these writers, or some of them, certainly Tanya Reinhardt and there are others, Ariamem Barkat. These people write in the mainstream press. These are not fringe journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
It's quite acceptable there to be less than punctilious about maintaining a clear line between when you talk about Jews and when you talk about Israelis and so on. So there's really a little bit of falseness, I think, in all the outrage you get from the so-called Jewish organizations in the United States when the lobby comes up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think that, the what they call the Israel lobby includes a lot of, I guess they kind of be known as a Christian Zionist. These are fundamentalist Christians who have a strange idea of the end times and Jesus will not come back until you have a state of Israel and a temple and all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, there are these people, and I don't know if it's generally known, but Christian Zionism goes back a long way. It used to be a very respectable doctrine, and the people behind the Balfour Declaration in England in 1917, they were Christian Zionists. To some extent, so was our President Wilson. These people are important, and someone just pointed out to me today that the criticisms that are made of the Israel lobby would be just as valid if not a single Jew was part of that lobby. I mean, the criticism is that the lobby has too much influence, which can be debated either way, I suppose, and has a bad influence, which I think is by far the most important point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I recall, you know, that back in the 50s, we had what we call the China lobby, which didn't include just Chinese people either. It was sort of based on the Chinese nationalists who were chased out of China during the revolution, and they settled in Taiwan. And very powerful at one time in Congress, it was very hard to go against the China lobby. But if you did, you were not accused of being anti-Chinese. They sort of called you a pinko and punished you for that, you know?
Yeah, and I kind of think that if you tried to go against the Cuba lobby today, you would not be called racist against Cubans or Hispanics.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did this come about? I mean, what accounts for this?
Well, if you mean the lobby itself, I have to say I don't quite agree with Walton and Mearsheimer about its role. I think that the lobby is very powerful, but I think its power is not entirely a cause of U.S. policy. It's much more an effect of U.S. policy. Because the interesting thing is that AIPAC, which clearly is the main lobbying organization, was founded around 1950-1951. It wasn't influential at all back then, which you can clearly see because in 1956, when the British, French, and Israelis invaded the Sinai, America lined up with Egypt on the other side against Israel. And people don't seem to realize it, but the United States was not always allied with Israel. It's only after it became allied with Israel that the lobby became very influential. So to a large extent, in my opinion, the lobby is pushing in the same direction as U.S. policy.
Right.
Because of that, it's acquired some independent power, and it can influence Congress, and it can pressure the executive. But I think that the core of that power really comes from the plain fact that U.S. policy favors Israel and has favored it for its own reasons, and this goes back before the lobbies became such a big factor.
Well, there's a huge overlap. I remember when Israel was founded, I was living in New York then, and Israel was kind of a left-wing cause because they were, you know, there was the memory of the Holocaust was very recent, and the Israelis, you know, they established these kind of cooperative farms, you know, socialistic agriculture, and left people thought this was just great. Well, they've kind of gone away from that since.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the whole idea of establishing socialism on the backs of some peasants who you've sort of kicked out of the area is a little bit funny. But it was genuine. It was sincere. I mean, the problem with Zionism is that it just so badly wanted to believe, first of all, that the Palestinians didn't exist at all, and then that somehow they didn't matter, you know, that they'd sort of fade away. I have a little collection of children's books from the 1920s through the 1940s, American children's books about Palestine and about Zionism in Palestine. And it's amazing how the Palestinians, you know, they hardly exist at all. Every once in a while, a shepherd sort of comes into the picture. And the whole idea, even into the late 1940s, was that somehow this wasn't a problem. It's something people just didn't want to face.
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous naivete about that somehow, you know, the people who supported Israel thought that, well, these Holocaust survivors who are settling in Israel would be sort of welcomed as, I don't know what, that they would somehow uplift the Palestinians or something, you know?
Well, yes, I suppose they did. Although the real Zionists were really not that interested in the Holocaust.
They were pretty hard-nosed people, weren't they?
They were pretty brutal people. Ben-Gurion said, I have the texts, he said very clearly during the period of the Second World War that if it was a choice between rescuing people from the concentration camps and building a Jewish state in Israel, he would choose building a Jewish state in Israel, which is why the Zionists did everything they could to funnel all Jewish immigration into Palestine, and were not at all sympathetic to the efforts of other Jewish organizations to just get the Jews the hell out of there anywhere that would take them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, you know, it's not the fault of the Zionists that a lot of Western countries put a cap on Jewish immigration, but they weren't too interested in removing that cap.
Right. It seems to me that at one time some of these Zionist organizations, they didn't want a lot of, after the war, a lot of Jews emigrating to the United States.
No, they didn't want Jews emigrating anywhere. But
right. Didn't they get into a dispute with Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was very pretty well-known figure at that time?
Well, I don't know the history as well as I should, but many prominent Jewish figures in the late 40s had very severe reservations about Zionism and what it seemed to be becoming, including Albert Einstein and Martin Buber. I'm sure there were many others.
Oh, I think the father of Yehudi Menuhin, Moshe Menuhin, wrote a book against Zionism, or a short book against it, and it's very hard to find these days.
Oh, yes. These things have all dropped right out of the picture. I mean, the level of debate at this point has practically got down to the point where, you know, if you criticize Israel in you know, some way that people decide is wrong, the answer is, ooh, you said that. It's really come down to that. And if you look at the things that Jews were saying about Israel in the 60s or the 70s into the 80s, you find a very different framework for discourse. For example, today, it is considered, in France, it's considered a criminal offense to compare Israelis to Nazis. You can find these comparisons very easily coming from Jewish writers in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It was okay for them, but now, when Israel really doesn't have any defense except piety, piety has become the rule.
Yeah, well, since Walt and Mearsheimer wrote their article, I guess the Zionists hoped that it would just kind of go away, but it hasn't gone away. There's still this controversy is going on, and a lot of abuse has been dumped on these two, I think, especially by people like Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, well, I mean, that guy's... He comes off like Elmer Fudd and Angel Dust or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just going completely crazy. But I feel that... It's a little unfortunate that Walt and Mearsheimer framed their article the way they did. I think it's too bad they put so much emphasis on the lobby. The debate that it's aroused, if you can call it that, is predictable. I mean, we've seen people marginalized before when they dared to talk about the lobby. There's a fellow in California, Jeff Blankford, who's...
Oh, I know him, yeah.
Yeah, well, he's done an excellent job on this. And, my God, you'd think the guy was Eichmann the way he's treated. So this happens a lot. But what bothers me about the whole debate is, it seems to me that the first question to ask is it a good idea for the United States to back Israel? Forget about the lobby. Who cares about the lobby? If it turns out that Israel is our wonderful ally and our soul buddy and all the rest of it, then why would anybody worry about the lobby? Then we ought to be saying, oh, there's a strong pro-Israel lobby. Well, that's just great. So in a way, just to talk about how influential the lobby is doesn't tell you anything. What you want to know is that going to be a good influence or a bad one? And I mean, I believe very strongly that it's a bad influence. One of the things that's come out in the debate over Walt and Mearsheimer, and this again has come from Israel, is that a lot of people seem to feel that the Israel lobby in the United States also works against Israel's interests. I mean, there's a very good and prominent journalist, a fairly moderate guy in Israel called Tom Segev. He said that in the last couple of weeks. And his feeling is that essentially what Israel needs is a little tough love, that the Israel's... real interest is to get the hell out of the occupied territories completely,
right,
and do it right away. And you know, if you ask yourself, why doesn't it do that? Well, it's essentially because they think, well, you know, we got such good housing there. You know, we got a good deal in cheap housing. That's what it comes down to. It's not a security issue. There are plenty of Israeli military and intelligence people who say that the occupation does nothing for Israel's security, which means, yeah. You know, all this stuff about, oh, you know, the Palestinians are foaming at the mouth, anti-Semitic, the beasts who will never be satisfied. It's all irrelevant. If you're so worried about your security, why the hell would you have little settlements of civilians scattered all over the landscape? That doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, to back Israel at this point and to make Israel intransigent about a settlement is not even in Israel's interests, let alone the United States. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. I've been feeling for quite a while that Israel is setting itself up for a real fall, that, you know, originally people wanted a homeland, and what they got was sort of a conquering militaristic state, and those are two different things. And because of that, they may their homeland ideal is in danger.
Well, yes. It's hard to know how things will go. I mean, there's always been a strong opposition to the current policies within Israel, but it's never been quite strong enough. And unfortunately, I think what's happening in a large segment of the Israeli population is what happens so often when a country has put itself in the wrong. People just lose any sense of reality. And mm-hmm. indeed, if you read a Israeli journalist like Gideon Levy, that's a constant theme he has, that people are simply out of touch. You know, there are an awful lot of Israelis who really just sort of, you know, that they go clubbing, they go to work, they live their lives, and they don't care. And with the help of American backing of various kinds, unfortunately, Israel tends to fall into the hands of extremists. Whether there'll be a reckoning in the end, well, maybe, but with a country that's one of the world's leading nuclear powers, you have to wonder how that's going to play out.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seemed to me that the key to this question of anti-Semitism is that you know, that we're not alleging that is, you know, that to say that Israelis and Jews misbehave, you know, well, a lot of time everybody misbehaves at one time or another. And the anti-Semitic way of would be is that there's something specifically wrong with Jews as a people that makes them misbehave, and that is not true at all. It's just that they, right now, they have a lot of power, and like anybody else, they abuse it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it should be pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm. Well, it should
no
be.
No amount of criticism mm-hmm. of Israel is in itself anti-Semitic. I mean, mm-hmm. you could say you wanted Israel blown up tomorrow and there wouldn't be anything anti-Semitic about it. But what you hear a lot these days from Israel's apologists is that, well, even if this isn't really, it doesn't mean something anti-Semitic, it's used by anti-Semites. Which is pretty silly because, mm-hmm. You know, if you want respectable statements that are used by anti-Semites, all you have to do is go to APEC's website where they brag about how influential they are.
Mm-hmm.
They brag about the effects they have on U.S. policy. And in any case, I mean, the idea that somehow you have to worry about even your accurate statements because they might be misused by anti-Semites, it's pretty silly. I mean, as if anti-Semites cared particularly about accuracy. I mean, you know, if they don't have what you say, they'll make something up.
Mm-hmm.
And they use anything. You can go to an anti-Semitic website and you'll find quotes from Gandhi, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this whole idea that you have to watch what you say or there'll be a wave of anti-Semitism, it just doesn't work.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, the other thing that is kind of the elephant in the room where anti-Semitism is concerned, is nobody really looks at just how harmful anti-Semitism is in the contemporary world. Now, I have looked at this. I've gone to the sites of the Anti-Defamation League and its French counterpart, and I've carefully gone through all the incidents of anti-Semitism from all over the world that they list in their accounts of this, you know, these supposed waves of anti-Semitism, and there are hundreds of incidents. So then you ask yourself, well, what does this really add up to? And if you have any sense of proportion, and if you think about what goes on in the world today, where you've got 3 to 4 million people killed in the Congo, nobody even notices, mm-hmm. where you've got 1,500, 1,600 orphans, children, shot in the street in Honduras, because they don't like orphans kicking around, nobody notices, wasn't even reported in the left-wing press. And you ask yourself, okay, let's say take a couple of years, 2003, 2004, how many Jews were killed? How many Jews were wounded? If you look at the Western world, the answer is, including Al-Qaeda attacks,
mm-hmm.
it comes to 9.
Wow. Uh-huh.
If you exclude those attacks, it comes to 1.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the number of Jews who required hospitalization, it's about a dozen.
Well, now, does this not include the, what does this include?
This includes all over Western Europe, Eastern Europe, the United States,
right.
North Africa.
Okay.
It includes everywhere except Israel, basically.
Right, okay.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, sure, it's not a good thing if even one Jew is insulted for racial mm-hmm. reasons. It's a very bad thing. But we live in a very bad world, and we have to set priorities.
Well,
you know, this mm-hmm. is just getting ridiculous. I mean, you know, in other words, the actual harm done to Jews in a year or two around the world is less than what you get in a fair-size auto accident.
Well, it's kind of like what I call selective outrage. You know, that's some outrages get played up a lot and some get ignored, like you pointed out.
Yeah, it's that. And you know, I mean, if you ask yourself why all this happens, I mean, it's clearly something that's generated in the United States. Is it all the lobby? Well, I don't really think that. Walt and Mearsheimer come to that conclusion because they say, well, look, the U.S. policy clearly has no interest in supporting Israel, and the lobby seems to be the only way they can find to explain it. I think there's a better explanation.
Mm-hmm.
I think what has happened is that in the 50s and 60s, the United States was really worried about the spread of communism in the Middle East. They were worried about Nasser, and they were worried about his successors. And this was, if not a legitimate fear, an understandable fear. It seemed like the Russians might set up nuclear missiles in the area. They might have deep water ports for nuclear submarines. Israel was useful then because Israel was, as they say, a stationary aircraft carrier, and it was right next to the most radical countries, Syria and Egypt, and you know, very convenient for Algeria, Libya, other radical states. And that's when the United States tilted toward Israel. Come 1990, with the fall of the Soviet Union, the whole reason for the alliance disappears, but it runs an inertia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially the situation today. I mean, the alliance is disastrous for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is supposed to be driven by oil politics. Well, you've got a country that pisses off all the oil producers in the region,
mm-hmm.
and a country that couldn't do anything to the oil producers without, you know, going through non-oil producing countries and creating a huge war, which would definitely mm-hmm. knock out some capacity. Plus, an often ignored point, if it came to military control of the oil fields, what would the U.S. need Israel for?
That's true. Well, I think we're going to have to end it there. I wish we could go on. We've been talking with Michael Newman, who's a professor at Trent University in Ontario. Is that in Toronto, or where is that?
Well, it's outside Toronto.
I see. Okay. Now, you've written a book, The Case Against Israel.
That's right.
And you have written a recent article, The Israel Lobby and Beyond, and that can be, if you get on the Counterpunch website, you can read it there. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay.
Goodbye.
We've been talking with Michael Newman about this recent article, not his article, but the one that's been arousing a lot of controversy about the Israel lobby. And thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned at 11 for Democracy Now! To hear a debate on the issue of peak oil with Julian Darley of the Post Carbon Institute and Michael Lynch of the Strategic Energy and Economic Research. And we'll hear a response from the Reverend Jesse Jackson about comments made by incoming press secretary, former Fox News commentator Tony Snow. And now a lecture by Ruth Messenger of the American Jewish World Service. This was produced by KBOO's Judy Feistel. This Sunday in Pioneer Courthouse Square, there will be a rally to bring attention to the ongoing genocide in Darfur, Sudan. Up next, Ruth Messenger talks about the crisis.